On Friday, Friday night, Ian and I travelled together to the BUV delegates gathering, and on the way I was asking him about his experience of singing in an opera. And I wanted to know about the difference between singing in an opera and the experience of singing with a choir. And he mentioned a number of contrasts and comparisons, and among them he said that there's a lot more prima donna behaviour in the opera. He told me that you see it not just among the actual prima donnas, because that's actually the technical name of the female lead in an opera, but among the chorus singers. And he described one singer from the chorus line who, despite having no greater profile or role than anyone else in the chorus, always jostled for the front and centre position in the final bows, which apparently is not popular in the company. We heard the story tonight about the disciples James and John asking Jesus to reserve a special place for them alongside him in his glory. And it struck me that Ian's story of the wannabe prima donnas would serve very well as an illustration for the kind of sermon that I've preached on this story in the past. Because James and John are seen to be wannabe prima donnas, trying to big note themselves and get the jump on everybody else in the scramble for glory. And I'm sure there will have been many very fine sermons preached around the world today saying just that. But as I was preparing to preach along those lines again this week, a comment from one of James Allison's reflections on this passage pulled me up short and drew my attention to something that I had never noticed about this story before. And now I wonder whether our usual way of interpreting this story actually falls into the very mistake that Jesus is challenging in it. What I never noticed before is that Jesus doesn't actually rebuke James and John for their request at all. He may even be commending them. He tells them that what they're asking for is bigger and more costly than they can imagine, and that he can't actually grant it, but the story doesn't actually suggest that he disapproves of their asking. The thing that prompts a rebuke from Jesus is not James and John's request, it's the reaction of the other 10 disciples to their request. It's the 10, not the 2, who cop a dressing down from Jesus. And if you're not convinced, look up the passage later. Once it's pointed out, it's so obvious that you can't believe you never noticed it before. So you can see my problem here, can't you? The 10 disciples were criticising James and John, and I have got a file full of old sermons in which I followed their lead and criticised James and John, but the Bible seems to be telling us that what stirred Jesus up and prompted him to deliver the rebuke was in fact that criticism of James and John. I might have to quietly delete that file while nobody's looking. So what's going on here? Have we actually got this story really wrong? And if so, why? Well, first let me say, if we have got it wrong, we probably don't need to be very hard on ourselves about it. Because prima donna behaviour, trying to big note yourself at the expense of others, is something that Jesus rebukes. We heard it very clearly just 4 weeks ago, which is about a page back in the Gospel. Jesus caught his disciples arguing about which of them was the greatest, and he was none too impressed. But if we've got this week's one wrong, it's probably because we've conflated those two stories. And we've seen James and John's request as them falling back into the same desire to be the greatest and looking all the more absurd because Jesus had just told them off for exactly that a page ago. But maybe they're not falling back into that behaviour. Jesus doesn't actually seem to think they are. How does Jesus respond to their request? He seems to hear their request as just an expression of enthusiastic support. They want to stick with him. They want to go where he goes. They want to go through whatever he goes through alongside him. They want to be as close to him as they can and to hang in there with him all the way to the end, till he's seated in glory. Why should they be criticized for that? Well, this time I'm seeing that Jesus doesn't criticize them for that. He challenges them about whether they really know what they're asking, whether they're really up to for what it would cost them. Are you able to drink the cup that I have to drink, or be baptized with the baptism that I'm to be baptized with? But when they stick to their guns and say, "Yeah, we are," he doesn't snort and say, "Fat chance." He affirms them. He says, "Unfortunately, you will indeed drink the same cup that I'm going to drink, and you will go through the same baptism that I'm going to go through. But as to whether you will be the ones on my right and my left when we get there, I won't be the one arranging that." Can you hear what Jesus is alluding to here? It's the cross. And the ironic, almost black humour way that Jesus talks about his impending death. When I'm hung up in all my glory, there will indeed be two hung on my right and my left, but I'm not going to get to choose who will get that honour. There's no criticism of James and John in that. We say the same thing in our baptismal vows. Come what may, we will follow Jesus and stick with him as close as we can. And now that I see it, I think Jesus almost sounds quite chuffed that they're so enthusiastic in their devotion to him. But the other 10 disciples are mightily pissed off. And as the story is told to us, it is their anger that Jesus reacts to when he delivers the rebuke about people trying to lord it over others. Why? Well, this why question is a bit personal, because I've joined in the criticism of James and John before. So if Jesus' rebuke is directed at those who are criticising James and John, I need to hear that directed at me and ask myself why I was ready to jump on them too. What was going on for me and for the 10, or for any of us who might have also jumped in and stuck the boots in? When I take a good hard look in the mirror, I realise that James and John make me feel a little bit uneasy, a bit inadequate, a bit embarrassed even. I like to think that I am fully devoted to Jesus and fully committed to following him, come what may. But James and John make me look a little bit wishy-washy. They make me look a bit half-hearted. They're a bit too extravagant, a bit too enthusiastic, a bit too gushy. And I don't like being outdone. So rather than rise to the challenge to lift my game, I find it easier to join in trying to tear them down. "They're not really any better than me," I snarl. "Just arrogant pricks who think that they're better than the rest of us. Just prima donnas trying to push their way to the front of the stage for more applause." But Jesus sees through me. Jesus sees that the one who is getting all competitive about this was not James or John, but me. And when I accused them of being arrogant and competitive, it was projection. It was me that couldn't cope with my own feelings of inadequacy and lukewarm passions and falling behind. It was me that was trying to lord it over them by trying to drag them back down to my level and insist that they conform to the lowest common denominator behaviour. James Allison's comments, which I referred to before, suggest that one of the reasons that we fall into this mess is that we have a quite messed up understanding of the role that our desires play in Christian ethics. that too often we have been reared on a belief that what God really wants from us is that we say no to our desires and live stern lives of heroic self-denial. Do you desire good food? Well, a real spiritual hero would spend days and weeks in fasting. Do you have desires for sexual intimacy? Well, a real spiritual hero would be celibate for life. Do you have desires to be super close to Jesus, to be one of his most trusted followers? Well, a real spiritual hero would curb their enthusiasm and maintain a cool and dignified reserve. Really? I don't think so. Sure, there are twisted desires that we are called to curb and renounce. The desires for retribution, for revenge, and for the humiliation of our rivals, these things have got to go. But passionate desires for a richer life, for more intimate relationships, for deeper commitment, for exuberant joy, and even to be recognized for our efforts, these are things that Jesus affirms and lives to the max himself as a model of the true humanity that we're called to. Jesus has no desire at all to see us turned into thin-lipped, passionless deniers of life. Jesus is not trying to stamp out our desires. He's simply teaching us to choose the ones that lead to an explosion of life over the ones that would slowly poison us in toxic bile. James and John wanted the best with all their hearts, and Jesus welcomed and celebrated their enthusiasm. But the 10 other miserable pricks resented them for it. Make that 11. I jumped in as well. It was all a bit too much for dour, sensible, careful us. You know what? A few verses earlier, or two Sundays ago in our listening to the stories, we heard Jesus telling his disciples that if they wanted to live their way into the culture of God, they would have to receive it like a little child. Perhaps it's actually James and John who were the only ones who really learned that lesson. It's not that little children are innocent. If you've ever lived with one, you'll know that they're not. But they are a whole lot less complicated about what they want, what they desire. Mostly, they just know what they want, and they run for it, and they come right out and ask for it, and they insist on getting it. And it's exactly that sort of upfront, full-throttle, expectant desire that is able to receive and embrace the culture of God. So if you've been like me, pointing the finger of condemnation at the Jameses and Johns of this world, trying to crush their passion and courage under the weight of our disapproval, then I invite you to stand with me and face Jesus' rebuke. But thanks be to God, it's not a terribly harsh rebuke. We're not being bound and cast into outer darkness to be punished. We are being invited to shake off our chains and to free our hearts and join the dance of passionate life. We are being invited to embrace our desire to be our best. And instead of directing that into pulling others back, to unleash it so that we might go freely and joyously surging into the future with all the passion and courage of excited children.